Welcome to the bulletin board. I'm Alice Posner-Supple for the Virginia Voice. I'm going to begin today with an article from Careers and the Disabled. Code physicist Ulitsky takes the lead at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Mark Ulitsky, who has low vision, came to the Lawrence Livermore National Lab with a doctorate in chemical engineering and was hired into a technical position after working in New Mexico at another lab. He felt it was the right time to switch jobs, given how his low vision was progressing. It was also challenging to get around since I couldn't drive due to my low vision caused by a degenerative retinal condition, and there wasn't much public transportation available, he recalls. He found out by a phone conversation that someone with his specific skills was needed on a code project at Lawrence Livermore, so he applied for the position at the Livermore, California headquartered Federal Research Facility, whose mission it is to ensure the security, stability, and reliability of the nation's nuclear deterrent. After about 7 years, I decided to apply for a group leader position, since I was interested in the inner workings of the division and being an active participant in how line management decisions were made. After 5 years in that role, he left Lawrence Livermore to participate in a 2-week guide dog training school in California where he was paired with Salem. I knew that the first year with a guide dog was really important in terms of bonding, and I wanted to focus my attention on that. 2 years later, when another group leader position opened up at Lawrence Livermore, he applied and was rehired. I realized that having Salem at the lab was quite natural and didn't interfere with my work, recalls Ulitsky. He works as a code physicist on a radiation hydrodynamics code. In this role, he's in charge of the turbulence and equation of state physics packages. I add new models, work with code users to test the new features or improve existing ones, and run problems of interest to compare to other multi-physics codes at the labs. As a group leader, he has line management responsibilities such as writing performance appraisals for his group members, participating in ranking, dealing with personnel issues, serving on interview panels, and approving time cards. For many years, his low vision only required that he enlarge the font sizes and reverse the contrast in many applications on his computer and use magnification to make text easier to read. But as his vision continued to deteriorate, he recently received training from a visual services company in San Francisco called Adaptive Technology Services. The training, paid for that by the Department of Rehabilitation, taught him how to use a screen reader called JAWS. In addition, he's currently in the process of getting a laptop computer that already has both JAWS and magnification software called Zoom Tech installed on it. He's also trying to get dictation software for more efficient typing. However, I perform classified work, so there are security issues that need to be considered, he adds. A typical day for him includes participation in physics-related and management-related meetings and doing technical work, scientific computer program in C++ and Python for his code project. I also need to carve out some time to take my guide dog, Salem, on some walks and feed him an early dinner before I head home, he points out. In the past, when he had questions relating to plasma physics or equation of state, he'd ask a more experienced code physicist who was always there for him. Most scientists here are very approachable and eager to share their knowledge and experience with you, he remarks. Currently, Ulitsky does about 80% to 85% technical and 15 to 20% management work each week. The lab offers internal and external training, and as a group leader, I'm always looking for candidates to send to the available training classes. The lab covers the cost of this work-related training. He's also taken some on-site training classes and works with the Department of Rehabilitation for training related to his low vision, such as iPhone, computer, and white cane training. In addition to all of this support, there's also the Lawrence Livermore Abilities Champions Employee Resource Group. It promotes the inclusion of interns and employees with physical, psychological, developmental, and neurocognitive differences as valuable contributors to the laboratory's mission, says Ulitsky. For information about the Lawrence Livermore Lab, go to careers-llnl.ttcportals.com. For the last couple of programs, I've been reading to you some of the personal profiles of people who belong on the board of the National Federation of the Blind. And this time I'm going to talk to you about President Emeritus Kenneth Jernigan, teacher, writer, administrator, and father. Kenneth Jernigan was a leader in the National Federation of the Blind for more than 46 years. He was president, with one brief interruption, from 1968 until July of 1986. Even after he ceased to be president of the Federation, he continued as one of its principal leaders until his death in October 1998. He was loved and respected by tens of thousands, members and non-members of the Federation, both blind and sighted. Born in 1926, Kenneth Jernigan grew up on a farm in central Tennessee. He received his elementary and secondary education at the School for the Blind in Nashville. After high school, he managed a furniture shop in Beech Grove, Tennessee, making all the furniture and operating the business. In the fall of 1945, Jernigan matriculated at Tennessee Technological University in Cookeville. Active in campus affairs from the outset, he was soon elected to office in his class and to important positions in other student organizations. He graduated with honors in 1948 with a B.S. degree in social science. In 1949, he received a master's degree in English from Peabody College in Nashville, where he subsequently completed additional graduate study. While at Peabody, he was a staff writer for the school newspaper, co-founder of an independent literary magazine, and member of the Writers Club. In 1949, he received the Captain Charles W. Brown Award, at that time presented annually by the American Foundation for the Blind, to the nation's outstanding blind student. He then spent 4 years as a teacher of English at the Tennessee School for the Blind, and during this period he became active in the Tennessee Association of the Blind. He was elected to the vice president of the organization in 1950 and to the presidency in 1951. In that position, he planned the 1952 annual convention of the National Federation of the Blind, which was held in Nashville, and he then planned every NFB national convention through 1998. Speaking at a convention of the National Federation of the Blind, Jernigan said of the organization and its philosophy, and also of his own philosophy, "As we look ahead, the world holds more hope than gloom for us, and best of all, the future is in our own hands. For the first time in history, we can be our own masters and do with our lives what we will. And the sighted, as they learn who we are and what we are, can and will work with us as equals and partners. In other words, we are capable of full membership in society, and the sighted are capable of accepting us as such, and for the most part, they want to. We want no Uncle Toms, no sellouts, no apologists, no rationalizers, but we also want no militant hellraisers or unbudging radicals. One will hurt our cause as much as the other. We must win true equality in society, but we must not dehumanize ourselves in the process, and we must not forget the graces and amenities, the compassions and courtesies which comprise civilization itself and distinguish people from animals and life from existence. Let people call us what they will and say what they please about our motives and our movement. There is only one way for the blind to achieve first-class citizenship and true equality. It must be done through collective action and concerted effort, and that means the National Federation of the Blind. There is no other way, and those who say otherwise are either uninformed or unwilling to face the facts. We are the strongest force in the affairs of the blind today, and we also must recognize the responsibilities of power and the fact that we must build a world that is worth living when the war is over, and for that matter, while we are fighting it. In short, we must use both love and a club, and we must have sense enough to know when to do which. Long on compassion, short on hatred. And above all, not using our philosophy as a cop-out for cowardice or inaction or rationalization. We know who we are and what we must do, and we will never go back. The public is not against us. Our determination proclaims it. Our gains confirm it. Our humanity demands it. Now we have something from the Boomer publication called A Four-Wheeled Fascination. Classic Automobile Collector Bruce Elder and His Stanton Museum. And this is by Jim Dusabella. It was a mystery Bruce Elder wasn't sure he could solve. Elder, owner of the Antique and Classic Automobile Museum in downtown Stanton that carries his name, had received a call from a West Coast friend. The man's client, whom he refused to name, sought a Shelby GT350H, a mere 1,000 of which were manufactured in 1966. He doesn't want any needle in the haystack Shelby, Elder was told. It has to be perfect. And black. Elder spent weeks looking all against an ever-tightening deadline. None fit the bill. Finally, peering up from under a lift in New Jersey, he phoned his friend. The Shelby he was viewing was pristine, for sale, and insanely expensive. Buy it, the friend commanded. His client, Tom Cruise, would be grateful. Cruise presented the car to Steven Spielberg, who had directed him and the car in War of the Worlds. The two took it to the 2006 Academy Awards. Tales from the steering wheel, Elder 62 has fielded hundreds of such calls from people seeking cars he either has on hand, and there are dozens, or a gem they pray he can find some way, somehow, somewhere. He found a 1940 Chevy pickup truck for William Shatner. He provided cars for Anthony Hopkins in the film Hearts in Atlantis, motorcycles for the Morgan Freeman, Steve Carell flick Evan Almighty. In 1991, he sold the actual car used in United Artists' Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Elder has sold cars for hundreds of thousands of dollars, but cautioned not to be too impressed. We're in an age where a single car can be bought for $30 or $40 million, he said. What I've done seems pretty affordable. Rather than focus on money, he basks in the tales of discovery. He was once delivering body panels off a 1933 Chevy Roadster to a man living in a tiny brick ranch with a two-car garage. Invited into the garage, Elder figured he'd be there a couple of minutes. Instead, he was led through the rear door of the garage into another hidden building four times the size of the house. Inside were dozens of rare Chevrolets. A Charlottesville lawyer hired him to sell the five or six antique vehicles he'd seen on a 600-acre estate he was probating. By the time Elder rummaged through barns and backwoods, that inventory had exploded to 94. Among them were two World War II vintage Alice Chalmers artillery-towing tractors trapped and virtually invisible inside a 20-foot-tall bush with flesh-tearing thorns 2 inches long. And there was the time he was led into a dungeon-like basement where you'd expect to find a furnace and water heater. There, bumpers mere inches apart, were 16 antique autos. I can tell you stories like that all day, he said. Equally engaging, however, is Elder's own story. The New Hampshire native began his business day. He dragged, literally, a Model A Ford up a hill into the family front yard. His mother was aghast that her 13-year-old son would engage in such folly. 2 years later, his high school principal wanted to expel him after he caught Elder playing hooky to go to a local wrecking yard to buy scrap. "School is more important than these junkets," the man lectured. Elder countered that his grades were fine, and besides, he was conducting business, and that he paid taxes like any other businessman. "Show me your books," the principal insisted. Elder did, and had trouble suppressing a grin when the gobsmacked man exclaimed, "You made more money than I did last week." Elder went on to work for an auto restoration expert, collecting cars all the while before choosing the path of discovery, sale, and memorabilia. "I'm a drunkard in charge of a bar," he joked. "I've always loved cars, and I still have a lot of personal automobiles. I've had lots of Chevys and Buicks, Hudsons, you name it. It's a lot of fun to learn about the people who built these cars, designed these cars, and every car is an education." It's an education Elder is happy to share with anyone, with weekend tours for the you-gotta-be-kidding admission price of $5. "Obviously, I don't make my living giving tours," Elder said. Inside the museum, housed inside what was once the largest Ford showroom in the South, among the vehicles Elders had on display recently were a 1923 Ford touring car, a 1924 Ford one-ton truck, a 1929 Ford Woody station wagon, and a 1929 Nash Advanced 6. Among the gems upstairs were a 1934 Riley, each part of which, save the tires, was literally hand-built by Mark expert David Jordan to exactly replicate the winning car at the 24-hour race at Le Mans in 1934. Scattered throughout the two-story building were a 1935 Packard, a 36 LaSalle four-door touring sedan, a 34 Packard convertible Victoria, and a 49 Ford V8 custom club coupe, similar to the one driven by Robert Mitchum in the 1958 film Thunder Road. Oh, and NASCAR race cars driven by champions Richard Petty and Darrell Waltrip. Just then, a couple and their young son, maybe 7, entered Elder's office. "He is absolutely crazy about automobiles," the father said. "Then you're in for an amazing education this afternoon," Elder told the boy, beaming as though reconnecting with the child who once hauled a Model A Ford up a hill in New Hampshire. And now this from Today I Found Out. And this is by David Hiskey. "There was once a little person who played in Major League Baseball. This man was 26-year-old, 3-foot-7-inch tall, Eddie Gaedel. Gaedel was signed by Bill Veeck to a Major League contract of $15,400 at $100 a game, which was the set minimum one could pay a little person performance act per event. Gaedel was an evenly proportioned dwarf. The term for such a person at the time was midget, with dwarfs who were disproportionate in some ways being called just dwarfs. When Veeck began scheming ideas to bolster attendance for his newly acquired struggling team, the St. Louis Browns, he specifically requested a midget as it was more socially acceptable in that era, where dwarfs were unfortunately often relegated only to the backstage or freak shows. Further, Veeck felt a midget would look more athletic in the uniform over other dwarfs. After reviewing several candidates, he settled on Eddie Gaedel, who already was something of a showman, appearing in circuses, rodeos, and the like, and was a member of the American Guild of Variety Artists. He also held more common jobs, like being an errand boy for a newspaper, and during World War II, he worked as a riveter. His small size particularly suited him for this job, as he was able to crawl into places on the planes that most workers couldn't fit into. Veek anticipated that Major League Baseball would be against this signing, so he submitted the contract for review late on a Friday, which would result in it getting approved without anyone looking at it too thoroughly. On Sunday, August 19, 1951, before the second game of a doubleheader against the Detroit Tigers, Veek had Eddie Goodell pop out of a papier-mâché cake and announce to the crowd of 18,369 that he was the newest member of the St. Louis Browns. Initially, people thought Goodell, being a member of the team, was a joke and that he would not actually be playing. When he stepped up to the plate to lead off in the second game of the doubleheader that day to pinch hit for Frank Saucier, at first the umpire, Eddie Hurley, wasn't going to allow him to bat. However, Veek showed the umpire Goodell's signed contract and the official roster for the team, and he was allowed to lead off. Veek had given Goodell specific orders that he was not to swing. Further, he was to crouch low in his batting stance to minimize the size of the strike zone. In this crouch, the strike zone was estimated to be just a few inches. Goodell did not do the practice crouch in the actual game. Rather, he stood up a bit more, so the zone was a little larger than it would have been, but still quite small. Veek's plan worked, and Goodell managed an easy walk. With the first two pitches, the opposing pitcher, Bob Kane, did try to throw a strike, but finding this too difficult, he just lobbed the ball for the next two pitches. Goodell then took his base, stopping to take a bow twice on his way, and was lifted for a pinch runner, Jim Delsing. As he walked off the field, Goodell was given a boisterous standing ovation. 2 days later, American League President Will Harridge voided Goodell's contract and he was out of a job. Further, Hardridge officially banned midgets from being able to play in the American League and removed Goodell's walk from the official records, although it was put back in a year later. After this was announced, Goodell complained in the media that Harridge had just robbed him of what would have been a lucrative baseball career. Veek responded to the banning of midgets from the American League with, "Fine, let's establish what a midget is, in fact. Is it 3 feet 6 inches? Eddie's height? It's 4 feet 6 inches. If it's 5 feet 6 inches, that's great. We can get rid of MVP Rizzuto." Veek even threatened to request MLB officially rule on whether Phil Rizzuto qualified as a midget or not. Future Hall of Famer Phil Rizzuto was officially listed at 5 feet 6 inches, but that's baseball inches, which aren't always too accurate, especially with shorter players whose height numbers tend to get padded. Despite the public show, Goodell hadn't expected to get to serve out the whole contract, and he even waived his normal right to 30 days of severance pay, which would have been about $3,000. This had always been more of just a one-day gig for Goodell. However, had Major League Baseball by some miracle approved the contract, Veek had planned to have Goodell used regularly in such situations as when the bases were loaded and a walk would force in a run. Goodell ultimately did get a lot more than the $100 out of his performance. He cashed in on his newfound fame, booking a variety of appearances, including TV and radio spots, and even playing in an amateur game. All total, it's estimated he earned over $17,000 in the few weeks following his major league at-bat alone. However, it wasn't all sunshine and lollipops for him after this. Due to the extreme discrimination against little people at the time, and that his fame tended to result in a lot more attention, often negative, than he otherwise might have received, he understandably developed something of a temper with people who made fun of him for his stature. He also began to drink heavily, which compounded the problem, where he would become combative even when no offense was intended. That all came to a head on June 18, 1961. Goodell got drunk at a bowling alley and apparently got in verbal confrontations with several people before leaving. Whether it is a result of this or that, he simply got mugged, and at some point between the bowling alley and arriving home, he was beaten up. His mother found him the next morning in bed, dead. He had been having heart problems, and the beating he took exacerbated that issue, resulting in a fatal heart attack. He was just 36 years old. We only have a little time left, so I'm going to read you some quick facts from the website Today I Found Out. An Australian man, Don Ritchie, died in 2012 at the age of 86 from cancer. For the final 45 years of his life, he lived across the street from the most famous suicide spot in Australia, known as The Gap, an ocean cliff in eastern Sydney. During that time, Ritchie stopped at least 160 people, with the unofficial number reported as high as 400 by his family, from committing suicide. How? For some, he simply gave them a heartwarming smile, said his standard phrase, "Can I help you in some way?" and invited them into his house for tea and a friendly chat. For others, he claimed he had to physically drag them away. Humorously enough, this angel of the gap spent much of his adult life as a life insurance salesman. Another fact, the idea that would become the Big Bang Theory, the science, not the show, was proposed by a Catholic priest, likely one of the greatest scientists you've never heard of, George Lemaire. In a May 9, 1931 letter to Nature Journal, Lemaire wrote, "If the world has begun with a single quantum, the notions of space and time would altogether fail to have any meaning at the beginning. They would only begin to have a sensible meaning when the original quantum had been divided into a sufficient number of quanta. If this suggestion is correct, the beginning of the world happened a little before the beginning of space and time." This would be coined later in a collection of essays by Lemaire as the primeval atom, which was the foundation of what would become known as the Big Bang Theory, after several other scientists would add to Lemaire's work. A couple of more quick facts. A few years after dropping out of community college in 1974, James Cameron found himself working as a truck driver. That all changed when he first watched Star Wars in 1977. After seeing it, he decided to quit his day job and see if he couldn't make it in the film industry. A few Oscars and several blockbusters later, we can safely assume he doesn't regret his decision. Titanic was one of his movies that you may remember. The original title of one of the most popular novels of all time, Pride and Prejudice, was First Impressions. The title change is thought to have happened because Jane Austen wrote much of her novel from 1796 to 1797, but didn't publish it until 1814, at which point there were two other works with the same title out by Margaret Holford and Horace Smith. Ultimately, Austen sold the full rights to Pride and Prejudice to Thomas Egerton for a mere £110, a little over $6,000 today. In the first two editions alone, published in the same year, Egerton profited £450. Since then, the book has sold approximately 20 million copies. So that brings us to the end of our time for today. You can hear the bulletin board on Mondays at 9:30 p.m. and a rebroadcast on Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m. or by streaming from the virginiavoice.org website. This is Alice Posner-Supple for the Virginia Voice.